All right, this morning we are on our last of five sermons, preparing us to go into study the book of Revelation. And you're going to have to listen fast because I've got to talk fast. Last week I mentioned that I learned something from John's sermon, and that was not to ask questions at the end. I sort of have plans for that if we have time. However, I want to warn you that if you ask questions about things that we're going to cover throughout the book of Revelation, I'm probably going to defer till we get through that, all right? If you want to know if the locusts and Zechariah are actually Black Hawk helicopters, you know, we'll have to wait and figure that out later, all right? I've been in construction, residential house building, all of my life, ever since I was about 13 years old. My dad was a builder. And somewhere along the line, I heard this rule of thumb about building. And it just was a statement that went like this, that a carpenter needs to be a trim carpenter or learn to be a trim carpenter or a finished carpenter before he's a framing carpenter. And I heard that years ago, and it's true. And the reason is the framing carpenter knows what the finished carpenter needs if he can finish out the house as well. And we're sort of doing some of that with these five sermons. We're putting up the framework, and then after the framework is up, we're going to fill in the details, and we're going to finish it as we go through the book of Revelation and see if they fit without force fitting them into our framework. You see an outline where there's three pages, the first two pages are review, so we're going to go through them rather quickly. The first sermon that we had was on the coming of the Lord or the millennial kingdom, and there are hundreds, literally hundreds of verses scattered throughout the Bible that implies or teaches directly or indirectly talking about the end time and people's anticipation or facts or information about the end of the world, about Jesus coming again, and so forth. And not just people, but nature itself. You remember in Romans chapter 8, it says, "For creation itself groans and travails in pain, waiting to be delivered or waiting to be redeemed." Speaking of that time, Jesus comes to rule and reign from the throne of David. This talks about a time when justice and peace are prevalent in the land, a time when righteousness is the rule, not the exception. And we talked about it as a period of 1,000 years that we see no reason, no compelling reason to take that figuratively. We take it to be literal 1,000 years. So we're going to be putting up the framework for a premillennial view of the second coming of Christ. And you see the timeline there in figure one of how that would look. You don't see any years, just the framework. Then the next week we talked about the day of the Lord. John mentioned this sermon. He had a handout full of scripture verses that spoke of the day of the Lord. It's an unexpected time of dreadful judgment, horrible things as God comes and judges the world and sets things right. And almost certainly, it seems that this day of the Lord would closely precede the millennial kingdom, Christ coming again as millennial kingdom. That's what the judgment is about, prior to the millennial kingdom setting that up. So you see in figure 2, the same with figure 1, just adding the day of the Lord prior to that time. Then the third week, we looked at the 70th week of Daniel. See this in Daniel chapter 9. talks about 77s. We talked about that term, meaning 490 years being decreed by God for the nation of Israel, the end of which appears to flow into the millennial kingdom. So you've got this 490-year period that it looks like the end of it is the beginning of the millennial kingdom, or when Christ comes again. The starting point, you see from Daniel chapter 9, and the ending point are given to us. The starting point being the decree to rebuild Jerusalem, the ending point being when the Messiah was cut off. Now, this starting and ending point is not for the 490 years, it's for the first 483 years of that. It says is the 69 weeks, the first 69 weeks. So there's another 7 years that are unaccounted for. The beginning of this point is a date that can easily be determined. I have a stack of books on Revelation, the Second Coming, that I've been reading and studying in the last few weeks in preparation for this, and I haven't found anyone yet who disputes the fact that we know when the starting point of this decree is. You see in Nehemiah chapter 2, verse 5 verses, that's in the 20th year, in the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of the reign of Artaxerxes. And history tells us very clearly that was in 465 B.C. when he ascended to reign. So 445 B.C. would be when this decree went forth. You can calculate it. It's been calculated. I don't know how to do it, but changing from a 360-day year to a 365-day year, taking into account leap years and all this stuff and the other issues. And this is another fact that's not disputed, that this would go from Nisan 1 of 445 B.C. To April the 6th, 32 A.D. This is pretty obviously the time at which Jesus would have been that spring and during the Easter time, or what we call Easter, when Jesus was crucified, made his triumphal entry into Jerusalem, was crucified. All right, that in Daniel chapter 9, you also see a false prince, talking about a false prince who would make a covenant with Israel for the last week or 7 years. And 3.5 years into this week, he will betray them and commit what is termed the abomination of desolation. Now, the next statement, apparently there's an unspecified length of unreckoned time between the 69th and the 70th week. All right, if we know the starting point of the starting point of this decree of when to rebuild Jerusalem was 445 BC, and it's a literal time that goes through 32 AD, then if this 70 weeks, if this 490 years is uninterrupted, then that last 7 years would have been immediately after Jesus was crucified. And there is nothing in that 7 years that happened that was a covenant with Israel, that was in 3.5 years later was a abomination of desolation taking place, and it didn't lead into what appeared to be the millennial kingdom. So it looks like this is separated. The 70th week is separated from the first 69 weeks. And I pointed out a couple weeks ago that this is not unusual in Bible prophecy. We looked at two or three places where there's a prophecy given. Part of it is fulfilled in one period of time, and another part of it is fulfilled in another period of time. So that's not an unusual thing. It might give us pause, but it is pretty common in biblical prophecy. So you look at figure 3, and we add this 70th week to our timeline. This prophecy that was given to Daniel was in 538 BC, and then you can see the rest of it on the timeline. Figure 4 is just that 7 year period, Daniel's 70th week, blown up. So we take that out and kind of blow it up, and you see the information there in figure 4 that comes from Daniel chapter 9. The covenant with Israel for the last week there, or for the last 7 years. in the middle of it, Abomination of Desolation, and then leading into the millennial. Then last week, John talked about the rapture and the different views of the rapture. He talked about a pre-tribulational rapture or a rapture that takes place at the beginning of the 70th week. He talked about some people believe a rapture that takes place in the middle, some at the end. And he suggested, and this is a view that we're going to see if Revelation fits, a pre-wrath rapture that is somewhere between the middle and the end. It is, you can't be determined exactly when it is, but it's between there. So you see that view there. Now today, the last of the sermons we're going to be looking at, Matthew 24. We're on the last page already, so we're making pretty good time, aren't we? They can slow down. Matthew 24, I'll give you a little background. And I want you to try to envision this happening from the perspective of Jesus' disciples. Jesus comes into Jerusalem, what we call the triumphal entry of Jerusalem. And he's riding on a donkey in fulfillment of scripture from, I believe, Zechariah. And that reminds me, last week during the last song, we sung a song, "Yet Will I Praise Thee," that I told y'all was from the book of Joel, and I got soundly corrected afterwards by a couple of people. It's from the book of Habakkuk, not the book of Joel. So anyway, that's been corrected. Jesus comes into Jerusalem riding on a donkey in fulfillment of prophecy that the Messiah would come riding on a donkey. Okay, so he comes into Jerusalem. His disciples are with him. The common people, a great number of them, are going before him, laying down their clothes in the street, palm branches in the street, in celebration, and they're saying, "Hosanna in the highest. Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord." They are making a proclamation that this is the entry, this is the introduction to the Messiah. They have been looking for the Messiah. Jesus' disciples have been anticipating that he was indeed the Messiah, and the expectations were that he would come into Jerusalem, overthrow the Roman rule, and set up his kingdom and rule from the throne of David. They thought this millennial kingdom that we just talked about on page one here was fixing to take place. Now, he goes into Jerusalem. Picture in your mind what they're thinking. They're waiting. He goes to the temple. He cleanses the temple. He overturns the money changers' tables, throws it, makes a wreck of the place it appears like. And I can imagine their hearts pounding. The adrenaline is flowing, wondering what's fixing to take place. But their hopes are not necessarily dashed, but there's puzzlement sets in because they see the Jewish rulers, the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the scribes, set up to try to trick Jesus. And through a series of three or four questions and interactions with Jesus, they ask Jesus questions to try to trip him up, to try to expose him as a fraud, to try to turn the people against him. And it doesn't work. Jesus' answers are shrewd. Jesus' answers are straight to the point, cuts to the chase, and exposes their own hypocrisy. And they finally shut up and plot to kill him. This kind of goes back and forth for about a week prior to the Friday of the Passover. And then Jesus pronounces the great woes of Matthew chapter 23. Woe unto you, pronouncing judgments. The word woe, as you know, just means damn. You are damned, you scribes and Pharisees, because of this, because of that. At the end of these woes, of these condemnations upon his own people, and I'm going to read to you the last three verses of Matthew 23, Jesus laments, Jesus weeps over Jerusalem. He says, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her, how often I wanted to gather your children together, the way a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, and you were unwilling. And now he makes the proclamation, behold, your house is being left to you desolate. For I say to you, from now on you shall not see me until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Now, this is a statement that is often missed. Jesus says, you won't see me again until you are able to say this messianic proclamation. Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. His disciples are standing by hearing this. At some point after this, you see in Matthew 24, the first verse, Jesus comes out from the temple, is going away when the disciples came up to point out the temple buildings to him. I think the disciples still are connecting him and the temple and the messianic reign and his rule, and hopes that this hasn't happened yet. They're still anticipating this to some extent, but full of questions. They're talking about the temple. And Jesus makes this statement in Matthew 24, verse 2. He says, do you not see all these things? Truly I say to you, not one stone here shall be left upon another, which will not be torn down. Now, most people take this, or believe that this prophecy was fulfilled about 40 years later in 70 AD. And I think that is right. However, a lot of people, or I shouldn't say a lot, but some people look at Matthew 24 and want to see all of it fulfilled in AD 70. They think that the whole chapter, prophetic chapter, was fulfilled just 30 or 40 years after the fact. And as we go through that, I'm going to suggest that I don't think so. I think that this verse in verse 2 was. In fact, the history tells us how this happened. When Titus came in and they overtook Rome in AD 70, one of his soldiers, in a fit of anger or something, threw a flaming weapon, a spear, an arrow, something, into the temple. And it caught on fire and became quickly a burning inferno. The heat from it melted the gold that was inlaid around some of the very ornate things. And this melted gold, it was said, ran down into the stones on the floor. And the Roman soldiers took the stones up to retrieve the gold as loot. Jesus said, not one stone will be left intact. It'll all be taken down. This fly driving me bonkers. Yeah, we got fly swat over there. I might just have to sit here and swing it. So some of it was fulfilled in 70 AD. I don't think all of it was. And as we go through here, we'll see that. The disciples, and it doesn't say, verse 3 doesn't say that it doesn't appear that they immediately asked this question. They're at the temple. They show Jesus. They're talking about the temple, and Jesus tells them, this will be torn down, not one stone remains on another. And then in verse 3 it says, and as he was sitting on the Mount of Olives, so apparently there's some sort of time gap that they went from the temple to the Mount of Olives. His disciples come to him privately. They've been thinking about this. And they come to Jesus and ask a question. And this is really three questions. Let's look at them. Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? Now, those who want to say that Matthew 24 was totally fulfilled in 70 AD want this to be one question. They look at it as if it's one question asking when the stones will be turned up and taken out. All right? But it's not one question. It's three questions. When will these things be? What will be the sign of your coming? And what will be the sign of the end of the age? The disciples are lumping all of this together. They're lumping together the destruction of the temple with the fact that Jesus had told them, you'll not see me again until you're able to say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. They're lumping that in with their expectations that the Messiah would come. So the disciples are trying to figure this out and put all the pieces together, just like we're trying to do. And they ask Jesus this question. If this is not the time, we walked with you as you came into Jerusalem riding on the donkey, expecting that by now you would be sitting on the throne of David reigning over Jerusalem. It didn't happen. It hasn't happened yet. If this isn't the time, how will we know when it is? There's their question. All right, Jesus' answer from this point on in Matthew 24. Is his answer chronological? In other words, does he give events and things that happen one after the other? Or can we not depend on it to be chronological? All right, think of that as we go through this. Verse 4, Jesus answered and said to them, see to it that no one misleads you, for many will come in my name saying, I am the Christ, and will mislead many. So here's one thing that Jesus says to watch out for. Israel, their people will be deceived by someone claiming to be the Messiah. It will happen not just once, perhaps many times. People will say, I am the Christ. So someone will say, I am the Christ, and will mislead many. So that's the first thing that Jesus tells them. Number one, Israel will be deceived by one posing as the Messiah. Then in verse 6, he says, and you will be hearing of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not frightened, for those things must take place, but that is not yet the end. So the second thing that Jesus tells them is there will be wars, a war, rumors of wars. And then notice that last part of verse 6, but the end is not yet. All right, so we get a little bit of a hint that this perhaps is some chronological sequence. Because he's told them some things, but he says this is not the end. Something else is coming later. It also means that he's telling them this is not the answer to your question. We're getting there, but this is not the answer. He goes on, number 3, in verse 7, for nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom, and in various places there will be famines and earthquakes. All right? Famine. Pestilence will take place. And then he says, verse 8, for all these things are merely the beginning of birth pains. Here again we get an idea that it has some type of chronological order to it. These things that I've named so far are the beginning of birth pains. Now, it's interesting, as we learned in our study a few months ago, that this phrase is not the last throes of right before a child is born, when the contractions are close together and it's imminent. This is the very first contractions, the very first pains that you feel when you suspect that you may be fixing to approaching giving birth. I'm struggling with my words because I don't really know how that works, right? Okay. The beginning of sorrows. So it says, here are some things that happen. Someone will come claiming to be the Messiah and will deceive your people. There will be war. There will be famine. There will be pestilence. And then he goes on to number 5, beginning in verse 9. Now this is a long section. Let's read verses 9 through 28. He says, then they will deliver you to tribulation and will kill you. And you will be hated by all nations on account of my name. And at that time many will fall away and will deliver up one another and hate one another. And many false prophets will arise and mislead many. And because lawlessness is increased, most people's love will grow cold. But the one who endures to the end, he shall be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in the whole world for a witness to all the nations. And then shall the end come. Notice those 5 or 6 words there. Giving an indication that I'm listening to your question. The answer to your question is embedded in this. Verse 15, therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who is on the housetop not go down and to get the things that are in his house. Let him who is in the field not turn back to get his cloak. But woe to those who are with child and to those who nurse babes in those days. But pray that your flight may not be in the winter or on a Sabbath. For then there shall be great tribulation such as has not occurred since the beginning of the world until now, nor ever shall be. And unless those days had been cut short, no life would have been saved. But for the sake of the elect, those days shall be cut short. Then if anyone says to you, behold, here is the Christ, or there he is, do not believe him. For false Christs and false prophets will arise and will show great signs and wonders so as to mislead, if possible, even the elect. Behold, I have told you in advance. If therefore they say to you, behold, he is in the wilderness, do not go forth. Or behold, he is in the inner rooms, do not believe them. For just as the lightning comes from the east and flashes even to the west, so shall the coming of the Son of Man be. Wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. Now notice what he says here. He says there's coming a time of martyrdom. There's coming a time of tribulation where you will be persecuted. You will be killed. Now, I ask the question if these things overlap or are they chronological in sequence? Now, I think that there is a logical order to the things that we've mentioned. We've mentioned deception, someone claiming to be the Messiah and deceiving Israel. We've mentioned war, famine, pestilence, and now martyrdom. All right? I think that there is a logical order for those things. And let me explain it to you. Someone claims to be the Messiah, and he deceives the nation of Israel. Perhaps he deceives the Christian church. Claims to be the Messiah, and they embrace him. And then shortly after, an horrific war breaks out, and I couldn't tell you what would start it or what the cause of it will be, but there's war. A natural consequence of war is famine. Lands are destroyed, crops are destroyed, fields are destroyed, produce is destroyed, and famine follows war in the ground where the war took place. We don't know much about that in the United States of America because wars haven't been on our turf yet. It happened in the Civil War. Part of the way the North defeated the South was like Sherman's march to Atlanta, where they destroyed the ability of the South, a great portion of it, to even eat. when the war is on your ground, when the bombs are exploding and blowing up things in Cleburne County, it will affect whether or not we eat. War is followed by famine, which is followed by pestilence, disease. 50,000 people, if I understand it right, died at Gettysburg in 3 days. 50,000 dead soldiers on the ground in a few square miles. That's a lot of death. That's a lot of disease. These things naturally flow one with another, and there is overlap between all of them. The next, the martyrdom, is also a natural thing that follows, because somebody, it's somebody's fault. Somebody is to blame. Whose fault is it that all of this war took place? Whose fault is it that the resulting consequence is I can't eat? Somebody has to be blamed. And it appears like that in this prophecy, the blame will be placed on Israel. The blame will be placed on Israel and anyone who supports Israel. And Israel will be persecuted. The Israelis will be martyred. Anyone who supports the Israelis will be martyred. And Jesus said, when this takes place, be careful, because when you see the abomination of desolation, or when you see someone taking the cherished objects of your faith and desecrating them, creating blasphemous things to mock your faith, when that happens, you know that you're in. You know that the end is near. Run to the mountains, run to the hills, don't take anything with you. Martyrdom is coming. The persecution is there. Then he says in verse 29, but immediately after the tribulation of those days. So here again you see an evidence of chronological order. Time after this takes place, notice what happens. There are cosmic disturbances. The sun will be darkened. The moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from the sky. And the powers of heaven will be shaken. Those are pretty dramatic things. I don't think that happened in 70 AD. Now, it could be symbolic language, but it maybe is not. I doubt if all the other things that we just read through are symbols. I think they're literal things. There's no reason, compelling reason, that I can see that this would not be literal, to be taken as literal. Cosmic disturbances like we have never seen before. Then he says in verse 30, and then will the sign of the Son of Man appear. After that point, after number 6, that point, then the sign of the Son of Man will appear. All right? Notice back up there in the verses we read, 9 to 28. For instance, look in verse 23. There, then if anyone says to you, behold, here is the Christ. In other words, if your people say, here's the Messiah, we found the Messiah. He says, if they say to you, he's here, don't go check it out. If they say, he's there, don't go check it out. You know why? He said, you're not going to miss it. Just like the lightning streaks across the sky and grabs your attention, you won't be missing the coming of the Messiah. That's all the point is about the lightning. You'll be sure. You won't have to go check in some room hidden away somewhere to see if that he's there. If he's there, you'll know it. No one will have to tell you. You'll know it. Now, these things that we've read from Matthew 24, can we fit them into, if you look back on the previous page, on figure 5. I've got 6 things listed there on the last page, 1 through 6. Deception by one posing as Messiah, war, famine, martyrdom, pestilence, and cosmic disturbances. Can we fit those things into figure 5 without forcing it? Okay, let's look at, see what common things there are. One, we saw in verse 15, right in the middle of it, when you see the abomination of desolation, Jesus says in verse 15. So there's a mention there of abomination of desolation. We see that in figure 5, right in the middle of that 7-year period. Toward the end of what we just read in Matthew 24, he says, then the sign of the Son of Man will come, and you'll see him in the clouds. That would be the second coming of Christ. I mean, it's what he says. So it looks like that would be right at the end of that 7-year period in figure 5. And it's probable that the Messiah, the very first thing, Israel being deceived by one posing as the Messiah, it is probable that that is the very first thing, the covenant with Israel. Israel is deceived into making this agreement, into accepting this covenant. So, if we lay that in to figure 5, what we just talked about, you'll have what we see in figure 6, the very last thing on the last page. Notice that some of the things overlap. Number 1 was the one posing as the Messiah. Number 2 is war. It is overlapped with famine. Number 3, with pestilence. Number 4, and then number 5, the cosmic, or not the, the 5 is the martyrdom that takes place there. And then you see you're getting past that abomination of desolation, which happens there in the middle. And number 6, the cosmic disturbances, is in that second half. Now, the pre-wrath rapture that we're going to be suggesting from our perspective, we're going to suggest that this happens at the end of that number 6, the cosmic disturbances. Now, if you look in Matthew 24, 29 and 30, I'm going to read them to you. But immediately after this tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from the sky, and the powers of the heaven will be shaken. That's number 6. Then shall the sign of the Son of Man appear in heaven. All the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they shall see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. And he shall send forth his angels with a great trumpet. They will gather together the elect from the four winds, from one end of the sky to the other. Now, you notice there where I've got the arrow pointing up for the pre-wrath rapture of the church. It's after those cosmic disturbances, but it is before the end of that 7-year period. We read back there that unless the time was cut short, no one would be saved, not even the elect. That doesn't mean the 7 years is squeezed down to 6 years. Or 5 years, doesn't mean that. The 7 years are determined. The 490 years from Daniel's prophecy has been decreed. 483 took place at the time Jesus was crucified. This last 7 years, there's no reason to believe it's not going to be 7 full years, just like the first 483 were full years. It's not the time that is cut short. It is the persecution that God is allowing his people to go through that is cut short. Now, there you see that on the right side, there's a question mark, weeks, question mark, months. There's a period of time, I don't know how long that it is, and I don't know that we'll be able to determine how long that it is, between what we're saying is the pre-wrath rapture and the second coming of Christ. There's a period of time there. It's less than 3.5 years, it appears to be. But whether it's a week, or whether it's a year and a half, I don't know. But I think what we will find will be that in that period of time is what you'll see take place in Revelation chapter 7 through about Revelation chapter 19. Horrible things. Terrible things. John read the verse last week, God has not appointed us to wrath. It's during that period of time when the wrath of God is poured out upon the earth. We'll see it as we go through the book of Revelation, and we'll see that time and again, John writes in Revelation, but they repented not. God's wrath and God's judgment is so severe, and yet the world is angry and shakes its fist at God and defies him and curses him through the whole thing. Right? Here is the framework that we've given you. As we go, we'll begin next week going through the book of Revelation, and we'll see if the book of Revelation fits our framework. All right? Questions? That's how you do it.